On this episode of Skeptico, science journalist and author of 13 Things That Don't Make Sense, The Most Baffling Scientific Mysteries of Our Time, Michael Brooks.
People might say, you know, come on, science, give us the truth about this. I'm not sure that actually, you know, people want the truth. I think a lot of the time in science and religion studies, people want validation of their original viewpoint.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we have coming up an interview that I did with Michael Brooks, author of 13 Things That Don't Make Sense. And I'm really glad that Dr. Brooks took the time to sit down and do the interview, because I was motivated especially to talk to him because of a public presentation that he did with Rupert Sheldrake. The whole topic of the dogs that know and the Wiseman debunking came up. And I think that my opinion was that Dr. Brooks really missed the point on that. And I had a chance to dialogue with him, and he really was pretty tolerant of me probing that issue quite a bit, along with several other interesting topics that came up about his book. So stay with us. I think it's a pretty interesting chat. No real news to report on the experiments, although everything is moving forward. And as a side note, with reference to Dr. Sheldrake and the Dogs That Know experiment, I can tell you that we've kind of resumed our efforts in trying to get that experiment going again. The one participant we had was just not able to really put it together, so we've kind of started the whole thing anew and moving in that direction again. And everything else is going along too. Much more to report on that in the future. But for now, my discussion with Michael Brooks, author of 13 Things That Don't Make Sense. We're joined today by science journalist and author of the very popular and very entertaining book, 13 Things That Don't Make Sense, The Most Baffling Scientific Mysteries of Our Time. Michael Brooks, welcome to Skeptico.
Thanks very much for having me on.
The book has become quite a sensation, and I think it's kind of interesting that it really grew out of an internet article that you wrote that became quite a sensation. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to write the book?
Yeah, sure. It was actually an article written for the print edition of New Scientist magazine that I was working for full-time at that time, back in 2005. And the idea was really just to kind of look at things that scientists can't explain. You know, we spend a lot of our time at New Scientist going over things, you know, that scientists can explain. It seems like a, you know, a fun idea to do the opposite. And when the article was put up on the website, it just seemed to go crazy, and everybody really went for it, and it became the sixth most circulated article on the internet that year, which was, you know, quite a shocking statistic, really. So I think, you know, what it showed was there is a kind of hunger for science and an understanding of science, but perhaps a lot of the time we sort of go about it in the wrong way, and you know, people are really interested in the mysteries.
I think that's a fascinating topic. You know, how did you come to be a writer at New Scientist, and what was a little bit about your background that drew you to science writing in general?
Yeah, I mean, my background is I did a PhD in quantum physics, and shortly after that, I kind of realized that I was far more interested in what everybody else is doing. I mean, one of my pet subjects is how, you know, when you get too involved in one particular subject, all of a sudden it can pale and, you know, and lose a bit of interest. And And I found, as a science journalist, it gave me the right to kind of go and wander through everyone else's labs and see what they were up to. And it just kind of, you know, piqued my interest much more to kind of get an overview of what was going on in science than to look, you know, specifically for years at one, you know, one detailed kind of aspect of science.
That's an interesting background. And I think it also, you know, one thing I pick up on is that you're not afraid to kind of get in there and mix it up a little bit with the scientists. And I think that's obviously because your background, you feel confident in your own foundation and science background. But how has that ability to kind of get in there and mix it up helped you, and particularly helped you in writing 13 Things?
Well, I think it was essential for 13 Things, you know, to be able to ask maybe some difficult questions, or to be able to stand back and look at a piece of research and not just take it at face value, but kind of dig sort of deeper than it went, and to also know the motivations of scientists. I mean, you know, when you work in a scientific laboratory, you're not suddenly a non-human being. You know, you're still a human being, and you take your humanity into that lab with you. And I think that's often forgotten in terms of what people research and how they go about it and what their prejudices are. And, you know, having sort of been on both sides of it, as it were, you know, I did kind of feel it was useful to know that, that scientists are human beings and they're flawed and they make decisions that, you know, wouldn't necessarily, you know, fit in with the normal kind of raison d'etre for science, if you like.
You know, I want to pick up on a point you mentioned earlier about the book and originally the article just striking a chord with people. And I think there's two ways of looking at that. The one way that you said it, I think is definitely true, is that there is this underlying interest in science that sometimes isn't picked up on by the popular media, and all we hear about is declining interest in science.
Yeah.
But I think there's a flip side to that, and there's a certain public disenchantment with science that I sense, and that I think that your book also taps into by kind of going out there and saying, hey, these things don't make sense and science can't explain them. I think that touches a nerve in people too, where they feel that science in some ways isn't relevant or maybe is condescending in the way it approaches topics that they care about. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do have lots of thoughts on that. I think that people do feel this sense of distance from science. You know, when they come across a scientist at a party or whatever, they don't expect to be able to understand what these people do for a living. You know, people have this, and we're talking in generalizations, obviously, because that's the only way you can talk about these issues. But there is a sense in which, you know, people think science is for the scientists, and it's not something they could ever, you know, kind of access for themselves. And I think that's damaging to science, and I'm sure scientists don't like that either. But the fact is, the way things have been set up and the way scientists have you know, become almost like the new high priests, as it were, you know, it's been very difficult to avoid that sense of us and them. And I think one of the most important things to do is to try and break that down now. And you know, after all, you know, it's taxpayers' money that's going into funding the research. You know, why shouldn't the taxpayers know what's going on and be able to kind of question what's going on as well?
Well, I think, again, that's interesting in that putting scientists on a pedestal, I think there's a real dichotomy there. I mean, on one hand, yeah, they're the high priests. On the other hand, I think, as you pointed out in one of your articles, about the inferiority complex that scientists have in some cases, and I think you're on target with that.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that taps into, we don't really hold them as high priests in some regards. In some regards, we hold them as out of touch and really irrelevant to some of the real debates that we're having in our society, and that they maybe are not offering us the best guidance that they could as scientists. Any thoughts on that, or you think I'm off on that?
I would completely agree that, you know, there is this kind of, scientists seem to react to, you know, to certain things, like, you know, they're always moaning about how students don't want to take up physics anymore, and they're moaning about how you don't get good science on TV anymore. You know, there's this kind of sense of, like, you know, society isn't treating us as we deserve. At the same time, I still think the high priest thing stands. I mean, I think people generally have quite a good opinion of scientists in terms of the work that they do and the value that science has. I think the problem is that people just don't know how to kind of interpret it and don't know how to live with it as part of their society. You know, so I think you know, what we've got is a kind of a double-edged sword where people recognize that science has brought us loads of benefits, for instance, in the modern world. Almost everything can be traced back to scientific development. And at the same time, you know, the scientists are saying, well, we don't get enough credit. They don't say that overtly, but, you know, there's this kind of attitude when you get scientists together where they kind of do start to think that you know, they should get more credit than they do. And at the same time, you know, I think people generally think that science, certainly in the UK, and maybe there's a difference between the UK and the US, that science can be a force for good. So, you know, it's complicated. It's not polarized, and it's not easy to analyze. But I certainly think that, you know, you kind of get this sense that there's something in the air about whether science is a good thing or not. People are unsure in many ways.
Yeah, you're right. It is complicated, and as soon as you try and pin it down, you can come up with a counterexample
that
kind of tells
right.
that the other way. I think one thing that I draw a distinction from, and I think you are doing it in the process, I think there's a difference between how people feel about and think about technology as opposed to science, and I think it's almost separated in their mind. I mean, they know there's some really bright engineers out there that will crank out the next iPod, internet, wonder drug. And I think in some respects they see that as different from quote-unquote science, what used to be science 50 years ago in Sputnik and Fermilab and particle physics and all that. So you know what I wanted to kind of delve into, because I think it maybe will bring the discussion, or at least my point, to a head. You know, you participated in a lecture there in London titled What Science Can't Tell Us, and I read about it on your blog, and I was just fascinated because it really drew out some of these points. And part of the discussion there degraded into, I guess, a debate about Sheldrake's telepathic dogs. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened with that public lecture, and what was supposed to be the purpose, and maybe what came out of it?
Well, I think the idea really was to kind of explore the limits of science. I mean, Rupert and I both are in positions where we're kind of asking maybe what people might call difficult questions of science. Certainly, you know, questions that not many people are asking. And the idea was to get us together, I think, and talk about, you know, whether there are things that science can't tell us, whether there are things that science shouldn't be claiming, and whether there are, you know, new and unexplored fields of research, really, that are unexplored because of some kind of prejudices inherent in science. Now, I think Rupert and I have different views on the last question. I know he's very strongly into his ideas of telepathy and action at a distance and that kind of thing, and thinks his evidence for them is very good. I'm not an expert on that field, but I, you know, reading around, I think there's not many people who agree with him, you know, in mainstream science. But I think it's interesting, and I said to him at the time that I think it's really important that people like Rupert do the work that they're doing, because they're constantly kind of prodding and poking at science, and science needs that. It can become very complacent and very self-satisfied, and I think it's not bad to be kind of challenged by people asking questions that you don't really feel comfortable answering.
You know, absolutely, and I don't want to totally degrade into recreating that debate, but what was so fascinating to me is it brings out some of the points that I guess I was trying to get across before about the disenchantment with science. And I think that, you know, the whole Sheldrake thing with the telepathic dogs, the first thing that I pull out of that is just how we treat observations like this. So somebody comes along and says, hey, you know, dogs seem to be telepathic. And when people say that, or say that about near-death experiences or afterlife encounters or things like this that are kind of widely reported among the public, the first reaction among science is this kind of condescending, we don't really have to look at that. That can't possibly be true.
Yes,
even if there's a pretty good natural history for it. In the case of dogs, I mean, Sheldrake even went out and surveyed people and said, 50% of people said that, yeah, they do see this in their dogs. And the part that I think is particularly interesting about that is I think scientists can sometimes have this, again, condescending kind of, well, you can't really evaluate that properly because you're not a scientist. And what I've found from my own kind of looking into this and research is that people, particularly dog owners, are quite able to evaluate whether or not their dog knows whether they're coming home.
Well, I mean, this is, again, I would say one of the limits of science. And this is something that scientists aren't very good at admitting, I would argue. One of the limits of science is that, you know, you take a load of data, like people's reports of their dog's behavior, and then you have to actually take those away and try and make sense of them, try and account for all possible explanations before you go for the most extraordinary explanation, which is the telepathy. But it's actually very difficult to know that you've kind of ruled out everything. And even with statistics, you know, and scientists kind of swear by statistics, but you know what, you can use different kinds of statistics to get different kinds of results. And I think this is one of the limits of science, is that where things are not clear-cut, actually, it's very difficult to make definite pronouncements. Now, scientists obviously are conservative and tend to err on the side of caution with this kind of result and say, well, we can't see any mechanism for it, therefore it probably isn't, you know, really happening. It's just an artifact of the data. But that's a prejudice, you know, based on, you know, what we currently understand as being the, you know, the limits of what can be understood. And I think we see the same thing happening with homeopathy in many ways, that, you know, people assume that because there is no mechanism, and the data are not, you know, clearly convincing. Therefore, you know, it should just be dismissed and not be discussed. And, you know, I had somebody say to me about my book, a very eminent physicist, that, you know, it contained issues that just should not be discussed. And, you know, that's a very unscientific attitude.
It sure is, yeah. Well, I think that that taps into something else I want to bring up, is the nature of scientific debate, and how I feel like in some respects it's really degraded almost to the point of like political debate. You know, when you hear two politicians debating, you know it's been. And so you really kind of start discounting everything automatically.
Yeah.
And I wonder, it seemed to me, again, that the Sheldrick and Wiseman example, because I've dug into it quite a bit and really have interviewed both of them, and I've dug into it enough to know that it to me, it just seems like spin. I don't know how you can really, if you look at it, see it any other way when Wiseman says that Sheldrick has reanalyzed the data. I mean, that's just, it's just complete nonsense.
Right. Well, I mean, that's a whole other debate, really. But I agree that there's a kind of polarization. And I know that Rupert Sheldrick would say that you know, Wiseman is coming from a skeptical position where he cannot possibly, you know, agree with Rupert. Therefore, you know, he will always find evidence, you know, against or reasons not to agree with Rupert's interpretation of data.
Right. What about that? I mean, do you think that goes on not only in this example, but in science in general, where someone really comes in with such a strong predisposition to see things one way or another that you're not really going to have any progress?
Yeah, I mean, we see it all over the place. I mean, it's particularly relevant in psi research, in psychical research. But actually, you know, it must happen. It's an artifact of human nature, in a sense. And this is what it goes back to what I was saying about scientists being human beings. You know, Karl Popper said that science is all about falsification of ideas. So you set up a theory, and then you try and falsify it. Now, you know, proving yourself wrong goes against the grain in terms of human nature. So, and scientists these days, you know, they have mortgages to pay, they have careers to build, and the important thing really is for them to be right. And so science doesn't really quite work in the way that, you know, purists would say it does. And people set up a theory, and others might try to knock it down, but people will then, you know, defend their theory to the hilt. And so you become wedded to, you know, your particular viewpoint on any particular subject in science. And so, of course, you're going to see this kind of sense of, you know, you're failing to disprove my data. You know, I'm clinging to what I've got. And it's quite rare, I think, these days to see a scientist back down and say, you know what, I was wrong.
Yeah, I hear you. And I just have to push this a little bit further, and then we'll move on, because
okay.
I don't know that the data ever really comes out. I mean, you take the case of Sheldrick and Wiseman and just dig into it just a little bit. I mean, first, you know, Sheldrick did the experiments for a couple of years, ran 200 trials. Wiseman ran 4 trials. And Wiseman's trials, I interviewed him on my show, and for the first time he admitted that his data exactly matches Sheldrick, almost exactly matches Sheldrick. Both of them found that the dog waited 80% of the time by the window when the owner was coming home, and only 20% of the time when the dog wasn't coming home. So all this nonsense about reanalyzing and it doesn't agree and all that, it just seems like such a low-level political, you know, let's just kind of throw up something that sounds good so that everyone leaves with this impression that, well, it sounds like both sides have some points, so we'll just call it a draw and move on. And I think that comes up again and again in science. It comes up, you know, in the U.S., the whole ID, intelligent design debate, or any kind of stem cell research, climate research. I think it comes up again and again, is that you have someone who isn't really in a very good position, but is able to kind of, through these really debating techniques and logical argument techniques, throw up this smokescreen, and everyone says, "Ah, gee, it's just another debate that both sides are represented on. Let's just move on." And
yeah,
it seems to me that science is the one place where we ought to be able to go and say, we can really get to the bottom of things if we just follow the data. And I'm not sure that science is as passionate about really getting to the truth as maybe we felt it used to be. And maybe it was never like that.
Well, yeah, I would agree with your last point. I don't think it was ever like that. When you look at the history of science, what you find is that people's ideas and the truth kind of comes out sort of over periods of decades, if not longer. And there are countless examples in the history of science where you know, people have presented data and it's just been ignored or it's just been, you know, kind of twisted. And so this is nothing new, I would say. And, you know, maybe with Sheldrake and Wiseman, you know, we'll have to wait, you know, 50 years before the definitive experiments are really done or because, you know, before everything has been ruled out. But, you know, I would say in that debate that, you know, what we've got is, as I said, a kind of polarized position. Very difficult to, you know, get a resolution from that starting point anyway. But there are so many factors that you know, one might work in to explain away the opposition's data. You know, and even when you've got both got the same data, you can both put a different spin on it. And this, I think, is you know, one of the examples of the limits of science. I think, you know, although we like to think that it can arbitrate between things just by, you know, analyzing data, that's not always true. That's only true in some cases.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think your book, Back to 13 Things, does an excellent job of kind of pointing out how these controversies arise and how difficult they are to really pin down in a lot of respects.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly are. And, you know, the history of science, as I said, is full of these things. But, you know, so is modern science. Today's science is just riddled with stuff that actually, you know, when you start to read it, isn't anywhere near as clear-cut as people would like it to be. And I have to say, kind of got into a lot of trouble if you read around on the blogs for even mentioning this. You know, there seems to be a kind of sense that scientists shouldn't air their dirty laundry, and that includes me. And, you know, there's been, on one blog, I think there was a claim that, you know, I should be stripped of my PhD for just even writing this stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because really we should be moving, or it seems like we should be moving in the opposite direction. I mean, the whole internet revolution and everything that it's brought in terms of access to information suggests that transparency is the way to go and disintermediation between the people who have the data and have the research and those who want it is really the way to go. So that's kind of an interesting position that we should kind of maintain the old guard kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there is a sense of that. I mean, the internet has done strange things to science in a sense. You know, physicists can post up their papers on this thing called the archive, and the physics preprint archive. And, you know, everybody's kind of posting papers up there, and it's almost bypassing peer review in many ways. And the peer review system is kind of, you know, clunking along with quite a kind of difficult life because there are so many journals now. You know, who's got time to read everybody else's papers and judge them, you know, when you've got your own to produce? So you've got internet journals that are coming out with, you know, papers that are being produced in order to create maximum impact. You've got researchers being assessed by the number of papers that they produce and, you know, what kinds of journals they can get into. And so there's all kinds of kind of political and economic issues sort of creeping into science now. And, of course, you know, career issues about, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And I think, you know, science is just, it's probably always been like this. I think it's probably magnified by the communications technology and the sheer volume of space there is to post stuff on the internet now.
Right. It's hard to know whether it's better or worse, but I get the sense that that's really better and that more is better as long as we have the way to filter it. But that just puts the onus on us, which is really where it should have always been anyway, to just blindly accept what anyone's saying, a scientist or anyone else, was never really the way to go.
No, I think I'd agree with that. And you know, maybe we've just got to be a bit more savvy these days about what constitutes, you know, good science. But I think, you know, there's so much science that goes on, and so much of it is kind of details. You know, it's filling in blanks. It's sort of dotting the I's and crossing the T's. And so much of it, actually, I've argued, is actually quite boring in many ways. You know, who wants to know about it? Who wants to read, you know, the kind of, you know, 17th decimal place of some physical constant? I think it's easy to do mediocre science these days. You know, what I long for is the kind of, you know, the real sort of revolutionary breakthroughs, and I don't see so many of those these days. And again, maybe that's a kind of rose-tinted spectacled view, and, you know, it was ever thus. But you get the sense that, you know, the major breakthroughs are further and further between.
Yeah. Let's move on to a topic that did generate a lot of stir and did generate a lot of interest in a lot of people's mind. And that's an article you wrote for The New Scientist titled Born Believers, How Your Brain Creates God. I guess that created quite a stir.
Yeah. It's, well, I mean, as far as comments go on the New Scientist webpage, it's gone a bit crazy. I think it's up to sort of 780 or something now, which is kind of unheard of for one of these features in a week. But yeah, it's a really fundamental question, you know, and it taps into the big question of the moment, which is, you know, where do science and religion meet, and can science say anything about religion? And the research that I'm reporting on really is kind of saying that religion can or could be explained as a byproduct of some brain circuits that would have evolved for other purposes. So it's a kind of byproduct, if you like, of how our brains are configured.
You know, that really struck a nerve with me because it's a topic that I think needs more coverage, but I'm just uncomfortable with the way that it gets talked about. It seems to miss the point in so many ways when we fall back into that false dichotomy of science versus religion. I mean, we have so many unexplained spiritual experiences across time, across cultures, scientific spiritual experiences, right? So we have near-death experiences with hundreds of thousands of people experiencing those after cardiac arrest. We have encounters of deathbed visions. We have no explanation for that. We have the power of prayer. We have no explanation for that. So we have all these different hands of science that are pointing towards some transcendent spiritual experience. Mm. It just seems kind of dorky to then say, well, why do people go to church on Sundays? Because there's some gene here. I don't know. I can't wrap my arms around that.
Well, I mean, at the risk of sounding dorky, I think it's okay to ask these questions. You know, why do people go to church on Sunday? And what's interesting about the researchers who I was reporting on is that some of them are believers and some of them are not. You know, some of them are quite sort of hardline believers in some ways. And some aren't, but they're coming to very similar conclusions. And the point is really not to denigrate people with faith or people without faith, but to kind of look for explanations of where this arises from. I mean, I happen to think that my article for New Scientist is a kind of a great call for tolerance of people with and without faith, you know.
But Michael, why do we want to tolerate it? I just want to know if it's true. I want to know if the fundamental transcendent spiritual experience that these people are pointing to, I want to know if that's real. And that to me seems to be the, you know, 700-pound gorilla sitting in the corner that everyone just wants to ignore.
Well, I would say, first of all, you can't define real. You know, what is real? Real is something that, you know, if you have an anecdotal, you know, subjective experience of pain, for instance, pain, you know, is real, and yet you can't define it as some kind of physical quantity. And I think when people are having near-death experiences, say, or other kind of spiritual experiences, it's a subjective thing. It's of the moment. It's not in a controlled scientific environment. And these things just, I think these things are another example of something that seems to act beyond the limits of science. And that science can only act with, you know, and analyze repeatable, objective experiences in many ways. You know, so what you can do with, people's anecdotes is take them and kind of, you know, and accept them, but it doesn't mean that that, you know, these experiences are definitely real.
I just can't agree with that at all, and I don't really understand. You know, let's go to the journals.
Yeah.
Take your example of pain. Let's look for how many studies and scientific reports have been done on pain. You want to take the last 6 months, the last 6 years? Thousands and thousands. And we can basically...
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that pain is not something that science can analyze, but we can inflict pain.
I understand, but hold on. You're talking about the subjective experience. I mean, we can shut down the social science departments, and we can rid our universities of about 35% of their entire budget and their entire school if we were going to not worry about the subjective experience that people have. I mean, it's so much a part of the soft sciences, psychology, sociology. We can't get away from that. So I just don't buy that we can't creep closer. We may never know completely what is real or what isn't real, but there's all sorts of work we can do there. We just don't do it because it's a taboo subject that we are somehow uncomfortable with.
It's definitely a taboo subject, and everybody I worked with for this article said that, and you know, we know so little about the psychology of religion because nobody would touch it for decades, and people are only just starting to do that now. Now, I mean, that's progress, so that's a step forward, and that's on both sides. That's the people who are religious and the people who aren't religious. Everyone's saying, you know what, we haven't looked at this, really. all I'm saying is it's a very difficult thing to do, and we may come up, you know, and here, you know, if scientists were to come out and say, you know what, we've proved that, religious experience is just kind of, you know, this brain state that, you go into, that wouldn't convince anybody who's had a religious experience, because that's a, you know, it's such a real and a visceral thing to anyone who's had an experience that scientists couldn't turn around and say it didn't work and actually convince anybody about that. And so what I'm saying is effectively human beings are religious and they are subjective, and we have psychologies and we have, and we've evolved as well to, you know, to have these experiences, obviously. So, all I'm saying is I'm not convinced that science can actually give us final answers in the way that you want them to. I know it's the, you know, the gorilla in the corner of the room, but actually, you know, we there are some things that we have to accept that, you know, we can probe them, but we may never get that final answer.
First of all, the article is extremely well written, as is your book, very entertaining and enjoyable, and I encourage everyone to read both the article and the book. I'm going to push this a little bit further because I just had a very, very delightful, interesting discussion with Dr. Peter Fenech. Are you familiar with Dr. Peter Fenech?
Only very vaguely, yeah. Near-death experiences.
Yes, he's one of the leading authorities on near-death experience. He's a neuropsychiatrist based in London and very, very well-written and successful with his books. I just think the point that he made was that we have this whole issue of death that we're just not at all approaching or engaging with, and there actually is quite a bit of data, quite a bit of good data, and quite a bit of good research that can be done in terms of investigating what happens, what's the phenomenology of death, and exploring that. And I think that, to me, that's so much more relevant to the central question underneath this than poking around about religion. But I guess I've made that point, and you've made that point. I certainly understand where you're coming from, which is, I think, one doesn't preclude the other and more is better. But back to our disenchantment with science, we can creep a lot closer to these fundamental questions that people are really looking to science to, and science isn't coming up with any answers. I think we can get a lot closer than we have been.
But is there not part of you that thinks that people are looking to science for answers that science just can't provide?
Science is a method. It's not a position. So the fact that science is just a set of tools, and the notion that we can't apply those same tools to any area of human experience that we want to look at, I completely reject that. And I think that that's the false bargain that we've made in this debate, false debate of science versus religion. And I think religion or spiritual people have just as much to do with that responsibility, and what they should be doing is joining hand with scientists and saying, look, we only want the truth. Study what we know, study what we are experiencing, and if it's not true, if it's not real, then we'll change. And that is essentially, I think, the position that the Dalai Lama has taken, and it totally disarms this whole false debate between science and religion.
I think that is the position that Dalai Lama has taken, and he has said that you know, if science were to disprove somehow, you know, the Buddhist approach has any sort of value in terms of spirituality, then he would happily kind of disavow Buddhism. I mean, he had an interesting discussion with a quantum physicist, Anton Zeilinger, once, where Zeilinger was saying that all events happen randomly. You know, at the root of reality is a randomness. And this is something that the Dalai Lama just couldn't accept, and said, you know, everything actually happens for a purpose. But he did say, you know, if you know, I ever become convinced about what you're saying, then obviously, you know, I will have to examine the roots of my religion. And he's extraordinarily open to changing his views. I think he's in the minority as far as religious viewpoints go. And people might say, you know, come on, science, give us the truth about this. I'm not sure that actually, you know, people want the truth. I think a lot of the time in science and religion studies, people want validation of their original viewpoint.
I think you're right. And I think that's the phony bargain that's in the background, is that, you know.
I think that's right.
Well, I tell you what, it's been absolutely delightful talking to you. I really appreciate the time. And the book is fantastic. It's doing great, I know. What is the follow-on to 13 Things?
That's a good question. I'm not sure as yet. I'm still kind of working so hard on various things for New Scientist that I haven't yet come up with that killer idea.
Okay. Well, we'll look for it in the future. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're very welcome. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Dr. Brooks for joining us today. If you'd like more information on his book, or more information about any of the previous broadcasts we've done exploring the Sheldrick Wiseman Dogs That Know experiment, which we've covered quite extensively. Those of you who listen all the time know. Check out our website. It's at skeptiko.com. You'll also find all our previous shows, our forum, and a link to send me an email. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.